This is KGNU's Morning Magazine. It's Tuesday, May 17th of 2022. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, more than 20 Republican-dominated states have joined a lawsuit to prevent the Biden administration from lifting an immigration restriction known as Title 42. We'll hear from an attorney with the Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network. This Week in Water examines the not-so-sweet side of sugar and other H2O issues. And we'll go to our comment line to hear what's on the minds of listeners. At the bottom of the hour, we'll have an update from the BBC News headlines. Then it's How on Earth? Today's science show features a conversation with Larry Gold, founder of the Gold Lab Symposium on the Science of Health, happening this Thursday and Friday. At 9 a.m. comes Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, Terry Reardon will be in the Boulder studio for the Morning Sound Alternative. All that's still ahead, but first it's time for local and regional headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
The Denver City Council passed an ordinance Monday to ban the concealed carry of firearms at city facilities and parks. The ordinance prohibits guns in libraries, rec centers, museums, parks, and concert venues, including Red Rocks. Council members passed the measure 9-3, with council members Kevin Flynn, Candy Sitabaka, and Jamie Torres opposed. According to the Denver Post, officials expect the law will take effect once crews post signs at city buildings and around the city's parks. The advocacy group, Colorado Ceasefire, notes Denver is the first city to pass restrictions on firearms after the Colorado legislature repealed most of its preemption on local firearms prohibitions in the wake of the mass shooting at King's Supers. The cities of Boulder and Louisville are considering other local measures to limit the carry of firearms in public spaces. Investigators with the Arapahoe County Sheriff's Office are alleging the partner of fired Aurora Police Chief Vanessa Wilson called in a fabricated child abuse hotline tip against Aurora City Council member Danielle Durinsky, an outspoken critic of the former police chief. According to the arrest warrant issued Monday, Robin Nassetta is facing charges of retaliation against an elected official and making a false report of child abuse. Investigators claim Nassetta called in an anonymous tip claiming Durinsky abused her 2-year-old son at restaurants she owns and during a holiday party for employees. The Arapahoe County Department of Human Services, the same agency where Nassetta worked as a caseworker, received the anonymous call on January 28th. The day after Durinsky appeared on a radio talk show and issued critical comments about the police chief, including a comment that Chief Vanessa Wilson is, quote, trash. The Department of Human Services found no wrongdoing by Durinsky in February. Arapahoe County law enforcement eventually picked up the matter in April to determine who made the false report and, as part of their investigation, interviewed Durinsky and others. The Arapahoe County Attorney and the Arapahoe District Attorney's Office traced the number of the anonymous caller to Nisetta's cell phone, and law enforcement recovered additional information from Nisetta's electronic devices and from her cell phone records, showing strong evidence of her involvement with the fabrication. Nisetta resigned from her position without explanation on May 4th, the day after law enforcement interviewed her about the incident. The Boulder Valley School District has received a deadline extension for shifting its reading curriculum for K through 3rd grade students. KGNU's James Swenson has more.
Classrooms across the state are preparing to replace the reading curriculum for elementary grades kindergarten through 3rd grade. The 2019 READ Act requires districts to use a so-called evidence-backed reading curriculum to teach students. However, some school districts, including the one in Boulder Valley, have successfully appealed to state regulators for more time. One concern brought up by BVSD administrators is that funding such large replacements for supplies and training can be difficult without providing the funds for such a significant change. Teachers have also expressed that the curriculum shift compounds disruption and stress from factors that include the pandemic, the Marshall Fire, and the King Supers tragedy. A few state-rejected programs have been used in elementary schools and are criticized by experts for encouraging students to guess at words rather than sounding them out. In the fall, BVSD's reading department plans to solicit feedback on these new programs. They will also include discussions with educators from culturally diverse backgrounds and from the district's dyslexia advisory team. For KGNU, I'm James Swenson.
The Service Employees International Union Local 105 elected its first Latina to become president. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
The 8,000-member Service Employees International Union, SEIU, Local 105, has elected Stephanie Felix Sayi president. SEIU Local 105 serves the service workers of Colorado and the Mountain West. The union represents janitors, health care and mental health workers, security officers, and the airport workers. Felix Sayi was appointed president by the service worker-led executive board and is the first Latino woman to hold the position in the organization's 83-year history. She will represent a majority women membership of SEIU Local 105 and joins an all-women of color leadership team at the union. A lifetime Coloradan from Greeley, Felix Sayi brings with her over 14 years of experience fighting to bring a union voice for service workers across the country, serving the last 7 years as the director of the union's healthcare organization division. Felix Sayi replaces Ron Ruggiero, who served as president after 9 years of leadership. During his time as president, SEIU Local 105 played pivotal roles in raising the state local and airport minimum wages, helped in getting new contracts for service industry workers with historic wage raises, and led for the passage of paid sick and paid family leave. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
The Longmont City Council will discuss alternative funding for the city's library during tonight's work session. This comes after a release of a consultant's report that indicates a library district or annexation into the High Plains Library District could be a sustainable option for the city's library. During the consultation process, Longmont residents also stressed that if the city does not want to increase its library funding, the city should then support a different funding model and library service operation. Other funding models proposed by residents include a county or city-governed early childhood education district, a county library, a city-governed cultural district, or a joint library system with the St. Vrain Valley School District. Longmont's consideration of new funding models comes shortly after Boulder City Council and the County Commission failed to agree to form a Boulder Library District. The advocacy group Boulder Library Champions reports its members have collected enough signatures to put a library district question to voters on this year's fall election ballot, along with asking voters for a dedicated property tax of up to 3.5 mils. Today's weather includes mostly sunny skies with highs in the mid-80s. There is a 20% chance of showers and thunderstorms for Denver and Boulder in the afternoon, while Fort Collins has a higher chance of storms at 40%. The opportunity for showers and thunderstorms continues into the evening hours, with tonight's lows around 50 degrees. The current temperature in Boulder is 55 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. More than 20 Republican-dominated states have joined a lawsuit to prevent the Biden administration from lifting an immigration restriction known as Title 42. The restriction, which was revived during the Trump administration, has created a bottleneck for asylum seekers at the southern border. A federal judge in Louisiana heard arguments on Friday, and many expect him to rule in favor of the extension. For more on Title 42 and its implications, KGNU's Rosanna Longo-Better spoke with Laura Lunn, Detention Program Managing Attorney at the Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network.
The Biden administration was planning to lift Title 42 restrictions on Monday, May 23rd, thereby unplugging a backlog of asylum cases that have accumulated since March of 2020. Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network attorney Laura Lunn says Title 42 applies an antiquated law from the 1940s that empowers federal health authorities to prohibit migrants from entering the United States.
The way it was re-implemented was, it was the brainchild of Stephen Miller under the Trump administration in response to the COVID pandemic, and the administration figured out that this was a really effective way to keep migrants out of the United States, such that they would not be able to access protection under our asylum laws. So I think the first thing to really like hone in on is that it's draconian to tie immigration policies to health policies because it creates this false narrative that the two things are at all related. And it harkens back to this idea that, you know, people seeking protection in our country are somehow diseased or something like that. But that's absolutely not the case. And it's striking how many doctors have spoken out and national experts on how Title 42 does not actually offer us any type of protection.
States that would like to keep the Trump-era immigration restrictions in place have found support from Trump-appointed judges. So much so that immigration attorneys like Loon argue anti-immigrant politicians intentionally file lawsuits in court where judges are likely to rule in favor of maintaining the restrictions.
Republicans are trying to extend Title 42 to keep asylum seekers out. But if Title 42 goes away, then they want to be able to create this bill that would also take away the health emergency that we have, such that it would then strip people of public health funding for COVID testing, telehealth appointments, things like that. So these, again, these two things have been intertwined and for political motivations.
Many immigration attorneys argue Title 42 essentially cancels legal protections for those seeking asylum in the United States.
There is refugee law and asylum law. So refugees, that's a word that people understand pretty frequently. That's designated outside of the United States. To be an asylee, you have to demonstrate that you meet the legal definition of a refugee, but you're accessing it within the borders of the United States. So you have to come and knock on the door and say, hi, I'm here. I'm afraid to go back to my home country. And our laws allow for people to process through and seek asylum where they show that they are fleeing persecution based on their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. And examples of that could be based on gender violence or based on violence against gender minorities, LGBTQ populations. So those are some examples of people who are protected under our laws. It is an international binding law for us to adhere to the UN Convention that protects refugees and asylees.
The legal fight over Title 42 is occurring against a backdrop of yet another refugee crisis. Loon says the structures from expediting paperwork for refugees exist, but the disparities are evident.
We have been successfully processing Ukrainian asylum seekers, like 10,000 asylum seekers in 2 weeks. And we could use the models that have been implemented to process those cases to then process cases for folks from other parts of the world. And it's very striking that these white Ukrainians are able to enter the country so expeditiously. I recognize that they're fleeing war. So are their Afghan counterparts. And that has been a much more challenging process, even though obviously, the United States is much more closely linked to the conflict in Afghanistan than to what's happening in Ukraine. And so arguably, we have an even stronger responsibility to Afghan asylum seekers, and we're seeing disparate treatment. And then if you think about who's been waiting at the border for about 2 years now, it's mostly, you know, Cameroonians, Haitians, people from the Northern Triangle, and Mexico trying to enter the United States to seek protections here, and they're not being able to access the laws that we have that would offer them asylum and a way to live peacefully in this world.
Remain attorney Laura Loon says that instead of shutting down asylum claims at the border, the federal government should instead invest in a court-appointed counsel for immigration proceedings so that eligible individuals can have meaningful access to the system.
A lot of folks don't understand that in immigration court, no one has access to a government-appointed attorney, and we need to come together and think through, like, how can we change this system in a meaningful way such that we can support people to make sure that they go to court, that they have access to strong legal arguments in support of their cases. And ultimately, the success rates of people with counsel are 5 times higher in a detained setting. And a recent statistic came out that unaccompanied children are 100 times more likely to win their cases if they just have an attorney by their side. Our immigration laws are incredibly complicated, and it is critical for experts to be in court with their clients to represent them in these proceedings, given that there is always an attorney for the government fighting for their deportation. We need people in court fighting to keep asylum seekers here.
That was Laura Loon, Detention Program Managing Attorney at the Rocky Mountain Immigrant Advocacy Network. For KGNU, I am Rosanna Longobetter.
Certain diagnostic tests, screenings, and treatments where the risk of harm or cost exceeds the likely benefit for patients, known as low-value healthcare services, resulted in $134 million in excess spending in Colorado in 2022. Eric Galatis has more.
During the first year of the global pandemic, medical consumers in Colorado received more than 1 million low-value healthcare services, diagnostic tests, screenings, and treatments where the risk of harm outweighs any likely benefit to the patient. Carrie Frank with the Center for Improving Value in Healthcare, the group behind a new report, says consumers and insurers paid $134 million for these services in 2020.
Even in spite of COVID, when people weren't accessing healthcare services the same way, we still saw high numbers of these low-value care services, and they cost a lot of money, both to the health plans and to the patient, and they actually can cause harm to patients.
The most obvious example of low-value care is when providers prescribe opioids for acute back pain without first trying alternative medication, a remedy that comes with significant risk of addiction and even death. Health providers across the globe, working with medical boards and other professional associations, have created a list and guidelines for low-value services through an initiative called Choosing Wisely. Frank says getting the word out can help bring down overall health costs. She says many services now considered low-value care were considered best practices at one time.
A lot of things are just, you know, historically, this is the way the provider has treated patients. And it takes a while when the guidelines change for there to be an actual adoption of the guidelines.
The average cost for low-value services is $130, but some, including peripheral catheters for patients with late-stage kidney disease, cost more than $14,000 per incidence. Frank notes every patient is different, and some procedures flagged as low value may actually be the right course for patients.
There might be family history, or there might be medical history where they have tried some other alternative. So there still needs to be that kind of communication between the provider and the patient.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
Time now for This Week in Water with Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
The not-so-sweet side of sugar. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
An over 20-year battle has come to an end along the Southern California coast after a state commission rejected a proposal for a desalination plant to turn seawater into drinking water for residents of Orange County.
The California Coastal Commission unanimously denied a permit application from Poseidon Water, which had hoped to build a 50 million gallon a day facility in Huntington Beach, south of Los Angeles.
The commission ruled against the permit, citing the plant's high cost and impact on marine life. They also detailed its hazards, including that the site sits atop an earthquake fault and would be vulnerable to sea level rise.
The commissioners expressed concern that the project would privatize water and likely raise rates, making it too expensive for low-income consumers. Additionally, they noted that Poseidon had not secured any agreements with local districts to buy the water.
Proponents of the proposal, which included Governor Gavin Newsom, said it would provide jobs and offer a drought-proof source of potable water as the state suffers worsening shortages brought on by climate change.
Opponents countered that there were better options, such as recycling wastewater, which is already happening in the county.
Last week, a campaign was launched in Florida to protect the public's right to clean water and to fight corruption, and it all has to do with sugar.
The organization called Vote Water seeks to limit the influence that large corporate sugarcane producers have on legislators, saying the industry has interfered with efforts to mitigate both air and water contamination and has received billions of dollars in government subsidies.
Vote Water claims cane production has polluted the Everglades, resulting in half the fish and wildlife having methylmercury in their systems. The chemical can also affect human health.
Environmental advocates say the sugar industry has blocked proposed projects to clean polluted waters that have caused coastal toxic algal blooms and other damaging impacts on marine life.
In producing half the cane sugar in the U.S., Florida companies burn the outer leaves of the crop, producing smoke and ash that harms nearby Black and Hispanic communities, a claim denied by the industry.
However, Vote Water says they're gaining support and the tide is turning against the industry. Earlier this year, environmentalists were successful in thwarting a bill that would have given the sugar industry an advantage over water management. One local official said that if the measure had become law, it would have starved the Everglades of much-needed water during the dry season.
Cleaner air in Europe and North America has led to a surprising result. More hurricanes in the Atlantic.
Particulate air pollution from things like cars, trucks, factories, and energy production has been reduced by about 50% since 1980, and a new study from NOAA says the lower contamination levels have allowed oceans to absorb more heat, which can fuel storm production.
Airborne particulates create smog that can reflect sunlight and have a cooling effect, the opposite of greenhouse gases, which trap energy from the sun in the atmosphere and warm the planet.
The cleaner air has been a key reason for a 33% increase in hurricanes in the past four decades. In addition, the land has become warmer, which has led to the movement of the jet stream toward the Arctic, creating conditions for storms to occur more readily.
Meanwhile, in the North Pacific, hurricane activity slowed, which the study attributed to industrial growth in China and India that added more particulate matter into the atmosphere.
And finally, when you're going out to eat, how do you decide what to order? You might consider price, calories, or just have a hankering for a favorite dish, but would you factor in the climate crisis and the greenhouse gas emissions associated with the food?
That was the premise of a study by researchers in Germany who wanted to see if restaurant menu design might influence the likelihood of a diner opting for a low-carbon dish.
They conducted an experiment in which participants were shown various menus with and without climate information. For example, some menus had prominent labels rating emissions associated with dishes as red for high, yellow for medium, and green for low.
Other menus had a low-carbon dish as the default and showed the amount of emissions a customer would add if they substituted with a higher carbon option like beef.
The researchers found that participants selected more climate-friendly foods when the carbon labels were present and also chose the low-emission dish when it was the default. When the menu displayed a high-emission default without a carbon label, nearly 60% of people chose it.
Given that one-third of global greenhouse gas emissions come from food systems, helping consumers understand the impact of their choices, whether at a restaurant or at the grocery store, might be one way to nudge them toward more sustainable options.
That's it for This Week in Water. Support comes from GC Green, a veteran, woman, and Native American-owned clean energy and resiliency solutions company. Learn more at gcgreen.com.
We now check in with KGNU's comment line and what's on the minds of listeners.
Hi, my name is Craig. I am a KGNU member. And I just tuned into Radio Nibbles. I know that's probably one of the most popular locally produced shows, and sometimes I enjoy it. But I wish John Lindorf would interview and report on more plant-based restaurants and options. He's not very friendly in that area over the years, that's for sure. That's all for now. Bye.
If you'd like to make a comment on something you heard on KGNU, you can leave a message at our listener comment line at 303-447-9911. We play the messages back on Tuesday mornings at 8:25. And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to Stacy Johnson, James Swenson, Steve Miller, Luis Licon, Jada Rodriguez, Rosanna Longo-Better, Jamie Sudler, and Franny Halperin for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host, Shannon Young.